Hi, I'm Michael Williams, Artistic Director of Sydney Writers Festival. We hope you enjoy this conversation recorded live at the 2021 Festival.
Well, good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I'd like to begin by acknowledging the traditional owners on the land in which we meet today, the Gadigal people of Eora Nation, the traditional custodians on the land in which we meet, and pay my respects to elders past, present and emerging. Now, this afternoon's session is entitled Have a Go, Get a Go, and the myth that Australian society is truly egalitarian, enough to give everyone a fair go, is pervasive, and we're going to explore that this afternoon. And in order to do that, we've got two of our finest economic and political commentators joining us. Firstly, Rick Morton.
Hello.
Here's Rick Morton.
Hello. G'day, everyone.
We all know Rick. He's an award-winning journalist. He's author of three non-fiction books. And a fine writer for the Saturday paper, and who has been exploring these issues of social policy, national affairs and science. Now, it's wonderful to have Rick with us. And also Keisha Napier-Raymond. Keisha is a reporter for Crikey. He joined their team in 2018. Before that, he was editor up the road at the University of Sydney at Honisoir, was an intern at the Sydney Morning Herald and a legal reporter for Justinian, and he has degrees of arts and law from the University of Sydney. Welcome, Keisha.
Hello.
And in news that is sure to shock you, I'm not Emma Alberici. Emma's been unable to join us this afternoon, so I've been asked to take the chair here and steer the questions. I'm Mark Scott, and amongst other things, I'm chair of the board here at the Sydney Writers Festival. So I think what we want to talk about is the state of the Australian economy, what's happened over the last year and what's happening now, and then deconstruct some of that. The Prime Minister spoke at the Business Council the other night, and he recounted an extraordinary series of statistics about the achievement of the Australian economy over the last 12 months. And his argument was we are in a far, far better position than we could have possibly imagined we would have been in April 2020 economically. And then he said it had nothing to do with luck. Nothing to do with luck. And that was the thesis of his speech. How lucky have we been in the Australian economy in the last 12 months, Rick? And how much has it been good management and good steering by the state and federal government?
Well, I was going to say, I never thought I'd hear myself say this, but thank God for the Federation. Thank God for the states and territories, who, including New South Wales and Victoria, even though Victoria had the lockdowns, for the most part, they followed health advice across the country. And, I mean, the economy is doing better than we expected, right? We have to agree with that as a general proposition. Of course, there are people left behind, but none of the metrics which are, you know, giving us these figures now at a federal level are because of actions deliberately taken by Scott Morrison or that he was willingly involved in, right? JobKeeper, they were dragged kicking and screaming to. It was an idea of business. It was a very poorly designed policy. It needed to be done quickly, I get it, but again, it came late. Remember, it feels like it happened 10 years ago now, right? But like, remember overnight when we announced lockdown and then all of a sudden there are queues in front of Centrelink. And it's like it didn't occur to them that people were going to need help. And the last time I checked, no government since 1901 has ever been in charge of the price of iron ore. So I think it's nothing to do with luck. I mean, that's a bit of a stretch.
What do you think, Keisha? I mean, good luck, good management.
Yeah, look, like Rick says, it's a mixture of both. He also says, thank God for the Federation. I would say, thank God for geographic isolation and being an island, and thank God for the kind of spirit of comfortable petty authoritarianism that we're okay with. We were very, very happy to close off the borders in this country, and we're very happy to continue to do so and continue to leave people stranded outside, because I think we, as a society, have made a kind of calculus. And that calculus is we will have our relatively normal life in an economy that is doing relatively well compared to the rest of the world. It's great. I would probably not want to be anywhere else in the world right now. But again, beneath that kind of triumphalist narrative, there are always going to be people left behind. They're going to be the people who are unable to get back into the country. And I think increasingly over the next 12 months, we'll see whether the position we're in now is truly a position of sustainability or a mirage. We'll see if that really does hold up, and we'll see how we handle sort of the next stage out of the pandemic with the vaccine rollout and, you know, when we start letting people back into the country. So maybe we are in a great position, but that position, I think, could be fleeting and it could come at a great cost. And let's see how that plays out, I suppose.
So so we're not great believers that there was no luck involved in this. I sense from the answers. But I mean, it can be said that in an economic crisis, everyone turns into a Keynesian. They really were willing to spend an extraordinary amount of money, that more than they would have ever possibly contemplated that they would have needed to spend. Do you give them credit for that?
I do, but again, and I mean, I don't like being the overly critical guy. I know that may shock you, right? I'm a care bear.
You are.
Yeah. But again, like the stimulus stuff, you see the story of the stimulus is in the stages with which it was delivered. The first one was tiny. Absolutely tiny compared to, and they were doing some tinkering with the RBA, obviously. And then the second one was enormous. And then there was an additional boost. Now, obviously, you don't want to blow your kind of gunpowder on the first shot. But again, timing is of the essence. And so I think it was, we needed the money. They spent it, but they still managed to be the coalition about it. And you know what I mean? Like, they deliberately kept universities out of the equation. They destroyed so many thousands of jobs for just petty, petty ideological reasons. And I'm sure you probably think of other sectors, Keisha.
Yeah, I mean, obviously the art sector was a big one that was continuously left out and continuously thrown under the bus. But I would say one interesting thing is, and maybe no one in the audience is going to agree with this, but we were perhaps lucky we had a coalition government in charge for the simple reason that I suspect that had Labor won the next election, they would have been so perhaps scarred by the way their last big stimulus was framed and the way they were attacked for going into deficit to get out of the GFC, that they perhaps might not have gone as hard and pumped as much money into the economy as they perhaps needed to be. So, I mean, yeah, the politics behind all of that is, I think, quite interesting. But yeah, they did go big. They did go bigger than perhaps a lot of people expected. But like Rick points out, you've got the university sector that was deliberately excluded, except for kind of international private universities. For some reason, they were okay. Domestic ones, no, left out. You got the arts, which were really just allowed to wither at the vine. And I think that that does come back to this long-running trope we've seen from a lot of conservative governments in this country, which is that sectors of higher education and the arts are just considered a little bit frivolous and not particularly important and economically productive. And I think that that's always going to be the worry here, and that's going to be the worry going forward, because do we continue to make the most of our strong position, or do we prosecute our enemies? I don't know.
So let's dig into those sectors in a moment, because I think there are interesting stories behind a lot of what we've seen now. We'll go to housing affordability and a range of other issues too. But if we are in a far better economic situation today than where anyone thought we would have been 12 months ago, cast ahead 12 months. Hmm. I mean, because I think it's very interesting that the rhetoric of the Treasurer has changed markedly in the last few weeks. It looked like budget recovery was going to be the priority, some level of austerity, but the pathway was really a pathway through to how do we get the balance, the budget back to balance, how do you repay the debt? That seemed to be the frame. That doesn't seem to be the story now. So what do the next 12 months look like?
Oh, I'll just get my crystal ball out and try to work out what's going on here. As Mark says, it's interesting how the framing has changed. Obviously, we're kind of in the pre-budget period where you start getting the drops and you start getting the little bits of information that are tossed out to the media to kind of furnish the narrative of what the government wants our reception to the budget to look like. And yeah, you had Frydenberg a couple of days ago coming out and suggesting that this wasn't going to be an austerity budget. And I think the reason for that might be that perhaps despite the relaxed and comfortable position we might be in now, there's less faith that that will last without sort of a less austerity-focused budget. I think there's a recognition that perhaps the fact that Australia, there might be impulses to close the borders for a little while longer, the fact that the vaccine rollout is sputtering and not going as well as it perhaps should be, is an indication that, you know, maybe they aren't as confident enough for them to return to the classic coalition impulses. But yeah, it will be interesting to see how that pans out. And yeah, beyond speculating too much, I suppose we'll find out the second Tuesday of May.
Rick, your thoughts on the next 12 months?
Look, I hope they're a good 12 months for the sake of everyone here. And I think they probably will be. Things are looking okay. You know, they want to get unemployment down to a number with a 4 in front of it. I saw that. It's interesting because you can just kind of imagine this, you know, the ghost of Maggie Thatcher just retreating from like Frydenberg going, I said it was going to be this year, but we'll get back to you kind of thing. It must hurt because it's quite, I mean, I'm trying to articulate this in a sensible way, but this whole experiment, right, is kind of an admission that what they do ideologically as a coalition is wrong. Like their natural instinct for austerity is bad because they can't do it yet. Because like, oh, actually things are in trouble. And what's interesting, I think, when you're looking at that is like, well, who's in trouble at the moment? It's business. Yes, obviously they want workers to get jobs and whatnot, but that's really about the economy as this homogenous thing, which oftentimes people forget that an economy is made up of people, ordinary people like us. And so this idea of delaying austerity and like them trumpeting it like it's, you know, they're like, oh, well, just not yet. We're going to focus on all this nation building stuff. It reminds me of that cartoon about climate change, which is like, you know, but what if we reduce carbon pollution and make the world a better place for nothing? And it feels like they're like, I was like, oh, well, you know, they're very disappointed, I guess, that they can't get back to their old operating rubric. Yeah.
Again, if we just look back 12 months ago, you can make an argument that actually at the moment, at this point, it looks more like a V-shaped recovery. Last year, everyone was talking about, you know, U-shaped recovery, V-shaped recovery, W-shaped recovery. All the letters of the alphabet were rolling out. But one of the things I think you would have said a year ago, you'd have hoped we'd be a lot further down the road to a vaccinated country, and you'd have hoped we'd have been a lot further down the road to open borders than we are at this time now. So how much of, you know, there's an advantage of Australia being an island and all the things you talked about earlier, but to what extent do you think there's a real risk that we'll find ourselves having not experienced the really deep horrors of COVID that we can see elsewhere, but that we will be that much slower to the kind of recovery to a normal international life than we would have thought?
Yeah, it's a tough one because I think that we are so comfortable with how things have played out that there's a lot of feeling that perhaps we don't need to move as fast as we should have on the vaccine. And I think if you look at how that rollout's happened the entire time, even going back to last year, we were one of the last countries to even sign the very initial sort of letters of agreement with the manufacturing companies. And I think the next thing to note is the way the government has really tried to play the vaccine rollout. So there's been a lot of kind of, I guess, triumphalist press conferences where they said, we've got a deal, we've got this, we're boosting production, that kind of thing. But really behind the scenes, things aren't going quite so smoothly. My 88-year-old grandpa is in an aged care home and has no idea when he's going to get the vaccination. And I think that says something really problematic about the stage things are at. I think the other thing to note here is the way it's been handled has been a reversion to classic coalition impulses, which is the outsourcing. And that's something that I've sort of been looking at a little in my reporting, which is that there's been a lot of money that's been handed out to big consulting firms who are not particularly transparent and you know, will put together a lovely sort of report or set of PowerPoint slides or nice graphics, but that hasn't translated to really good action on the ground. So yeah, we're in a real mess here. And I think as other countries return to a vaccinated normal, it's going to make opening borders difficult. It's going to make reintegrating with the rest of the world difficult. And it's going to lead to a sense of real, potentially a sense of economic isolation. And that might mean that whatever recovery we have now is really sort of scuppered in the future, I suppose.
Rick, you do a lot of writing on big government policy areas and policy reform and areas of health and other parts of public policy. Why do you think, I mean, Australia that you know, on you know, global comparators managed 2020 COVID-19 so well, Why have we so struggled to roll out an effective vaccination policy, given how much is at stake? And even if in fact you just said the federal government was looking at everything through an economic lens, driving economic growth and trying to get back to internationalism, why, given how much was at stake, has the vaccine rollout been so poor?
Hubris. a God complex, I guess. I mean, I don't want to retread, you know, old memes or anything like that, but like everything the federal government was responsible for, it fucked up, quite frankly, in this pandemic, specifically quarantine, specifically the vaccination program. I mean, the announcements, it's like holding a press conference every 45 minutes to announce to your parents you've cleaned your room, but you actually haven't. Like, at some point, they're just going to barge in there and go, what the hell have you been doing? Like, what have they... They've got all of the resources known to, like, Australian mankind, and they can't deliver. And I think historically, obviously, Commonwealth public sector isn't a delivery institution. It's bad at it. So again, why are they standing in the way of solutions? You know, I believe now some state governments have offered to help with the vaccination program in aged care. So few disabled people in institutions who are part of the same cohort have been vaccinated. It is like, I actually can't understand how they got this wrong so badly. Like, I just can't get my head around it.
And so much of it was really entirely predictable. I mean, we knew that trying to get millions of people vaccinated by October was going to be really, really hard. And we knew that there were going to be teething problems between the Commonwealth and the states, because vaccination is traditionally done by the states, but you have the Commonwealth sort of in charge of this program. We knew that that was going to cause difficulties. We knew that getting into aged care homes was going to be hard. We could have foreseen a lot of these problems. And I think that it's astonishing to me that they were foreseeable, but they weren't really addressed.
let me ask you something someone put to me, just the proposition that in Canberra there has been concern at how much credit has gone to the state governments for managing last year and managing COVID, and that the federal government wanted to control the vaccine rollout because they wanted the credit for that.
Yep, that was their last chance, right? It's like coming in after everyone's been arrested at a crime scene and then just jumping on some bystander and be like, I did my bit. I helped get a crook. And it's just silly. Like, it is like chest thumping. I mean, look, do you want me to get really kind of not provocative, because that's, I'm a Care Bear, remember? But it's just kind of men, like just men making decisions to make themselves look heroic and good. And it's like, what are you doing? And they were so upset. And I heard this from multiple people last year. They were so upset. You know, some journos got calls from the Prime Minister's office when they wrote about how the states did most of the heavy lifting. And it was not a call to correct a fact, which is, you know, par for the course. It was just to be like, what about it? Like, literally, that's basically, I've dealt with that office, and that's kind of how they talk.
That's the narrative. full of insights this afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. We're talking about JobKeeper because, you know, almost the centrepiece policy in many ways. You've talked a little bit about how it came about, but there was a lot of speculation as to what the economic impact would be when JobKeeper finished in March. Government's already saying, well, we haven't seen the catastrophe that some were anticipating. How do you think, you know, once we fully see the data, what do you think the impact of the demise of JobKeeper is going to be?
Look, I must admit I was a little bit shocked that we didn't see the impact we thought we would. And it's, I remember I was on the drum recently and some guy from the Northern Beaches, not you, Mark.
God's country, we call it. Go on, carry on.
He emailed me. He's like, I suspect you would be really unhappy if Scott Morrison actually managed to meet our 2050 climate targets. And I'm like, no, I'd be stoked. I just don't think it's going to happen, Richard from Avalon. I hope your house gets swallowed by the ocean. I don't actually, that would be mean, but there is clearly an effect, right? I mean, people talked about the cliff. You've got a program that is either supporting thousands, tens of thousands of jobs that may or may not have been there were it not for JobKeeper suddenly ending. Now, I didn't anticipate that any employers would fire people as soon as JobKeeper ended. But it's now a kind of month-by-month proposition, it feels like, about, well, can we afford to keep these people on? And it's contingent on, I suspect, the vaccination rollout and a bunch of other factors about whether this thing just hits the fan, which I just don't know if that's going to happen. It might not. But if it does happen, and I don't want them to fail, this Richard from Avalon, I'm not willing them to fail. But I'm wary of, you know, doing the George W. Bush thing and standing on the aircraft carrier and saying, mission accomplished, because I just don't think we're out of the woods yet.
No, I agree. It has been interesting that there hasn't been a big sort of falling off the cliff. I suppose that's a good thing. But let's talk again about the vaccine rollout. When we were looking at the budget last year, a lot of their kind of more optimistic pronouncements about the state of where the economy would be 12 months on were contingent on a successful rollout, were contingent on them starting to get international arrivals back in, were contingent on things like, you know, bringing international students back into our cities and revitalising precincts around our universities, like where we are right now. All of that stuff is probably not going to happen. So, yeah, we'll have to sort of play it by ear and see how the months after progress. But I think one more thing I'd like to return to on the whole JobKeeper issue is how many very large companies were able to line their pockets and pay out their shareholders and CEOs on the back of JobKeeper. And I think that goes back to what Rick was saying earlier about you had this big moment of surprising Keynesianism from a sort of laissez-faire liberal government, but even then they managed to do it with a little bit of liberal impulses there. They managed to do it with throwing a few bones out to their buddies and that kind of thing. And I think that points to some real issues with the design of the project and the design of this whole recovery.
And remarkably incurious about getting that money back when like they're now raising the prospect of levying debts on disabled people on the NDIS for money that they overpay or just pay for support. And it's like, well, you know, Lindsay Fox or whoever's got this money, nothing we can do about it. And I'm like, it's remarkable what they're willing to pursue and what they're not.
One of the things you'd have said if you study, history about leaders through crisis is that often what they try and do is bring the country together. You know, it's a crisis and to call us together in a common pursuit of the common good. Do you think Australia is more unified now than it was a year ago?
No. I'm going to say no, but I will preface
so,
that.
So well, let's talk then about where are the fault lines? Because I think at a high level, you could have said national crisis called together, somewhat compliant nation. We put on our masks. We did as we told. We played as the way the government called us to do. But, you know, I think there's an interesting thesis as to whether, in fact, this is uniting us or dividing us now and where you see the fault lines of division emerging in society.
I think, yeah, there are some areas that are unified. And I hate to bring like political polling back into this, but it's interesting to me that at a federal level, the government is not sort of smashing it in the polls the way that you might expect for a government that had really supposedly succeeded at handling
and the way
crisis.
That state government
and that was the next thing I was going to say. At a state level, you know, you saw Mark McGowan is now the emperor of WA and in the situation in Queensland. But the other thing about Emperor Mark McGowan in WA is it shows another thing that's united us, and that is the sort of I guess the drawbridge effect. We're very much united in our sort of desire or comfort with locking out outsiders. There's not really much political pressure to bring people back into the country. There's not really much political pressure to open up our borders. There's not really much. And when Mark McGowan locks up WA, he soars back to a big election victory. So I think maybe the fault lines here are perhaps between the us and them, the us and the outsiders, perhaps. And maybe, yeah, at a federal level, though, I think the government is maybe not succeeding the way that they could be out of this crisis. But yeah, it's hard to say where we're divided and where we're not. Fault lines are coming and going all the time.
Where are you seeing the fault lines, Rick?
Just on that point, very briefly, you get the sense that, you know, we're the kind of country that would cheer when we pry people off the lifeboats on the Titanic, just because, like, we survived kind of thing, but you're bringing us down. And that's what the border stuff feels to me. And I don't say that to be like, oh, you know, we're not a great country. We are. We're doing great in other areas. But, I mean, to me, the fault line, nothing, this was already happening, but there is this kind of like war between versions of truth happening. And it's really like, it's causing me to lose sleep, right? And it's bad for my mental health, largely because I see people I like and people prosecuting an otherwise good cause just lying about things or getting facts wrong and being corrected and not willing to address them. And it's happening across the political spectrum, right? But people are so untrusting now that they don't want to believe an actual fact. And there are so few facts. Everything else is almost purely subjective, right? So you would have thought that we could at least agree on that. And I feel like that signifies something deeper about where we're headed. And it doesn't fill me with much happiness.
Yeah, I suppose that is a sign that the democratic challenges that are happening across the Western world in terms of political polarization are challenges that we face in Australia and will continue to face here. I think we'll probably see that play out in the election sort of next year. I think we might maybe see a fairly divided country as elections tend to bring about, but I think that we'll just see that accelerate and that polarization maybe deepen. But yeah, I think that's happening everywhere, and we can pin that back to the internet and social media and all kinds of things, but I think that's another several hours of discussion before we can really drill into that properly.
And the great evil one is coursing through social media. Mm.
So, look, we're half an hour into this session now, and it is the Sydney Writers' Festival, so let's turn to real estate. talk about property ownership as a fault line, and what's the political impact of a generation of young people thinking not only may they not even be able to afford a property in Sydney, but they once thought Newcastle, Wollongong, up the coast, Bathurst, Orange, that housing affordability just seems to be sliding further and further away.
Ah, this is such a classic Sydney area of conversation. But look, I'm at the age where some of my peers who have generous parents or who've, you know, stumbled into wealth are starting to get in the market. And something that always strikes me as quite interesting is when they put up that post on Instagram of the first house they buy, they always get congratulated. And no one congratulates you when you buy a pair of jeans. I think you should get congratulated maybe for, I suppose, like a job or getting engaged or something like that. But this is literally them purchasing something. I think that says something very interesting about how we view property in this country, whereby when you are in the market, when you've made that investment, it's sort of equated with a bit of moral virtue. And that goes through the discourse around, you know, the articles about the people that self-flagellated for 4 years by eating tuna and rice such that they could buy their first apartment. You know, the stuff about avocados and all that crap. you know, getting in the market is seen as a sign that you're a financially mature and a good person. And I think that the corollary of that is there is this desperation to get in the market, but also that what it means is the people that are not, people who are renting, or God forbid, people who are in social housing, in public housing, are seen as less morally virtuous. They're seen as a victim not of, you know, circumstances beyond their control, but people that didn't have the self-control to make the morally virtuous decision to buy that property in the first place. I think we can't really talk about property and rising prices without drilling into the ideological way with which we view it in this country.
What do you think, Rick?
I agree with almost all of that. I mean, my it's not really about whether you own a house, right? And if you want to own a house, you should be able to, and you should be able to afford it. But it's really just about stability. Like, I mean, of all the social kind of issues that affect people in life, if you don't have housing, if you don't have somewhere safe to be, then everything else, well, nothing else follows. You don't manage to get to your health appointments. You don't manage to keep your chronic illness in check. You can't safely look for a job, or you don't have the energy to look for a job. And now, for most people, because of the way renting laws are so stacked against renters in this country, this is probably the part where we lose the audience, not to prejudge the level of home ownership here. Okay, I'm going to say this in another way, right? I wrote this book on money. It's an essay, and I allowed myself to be a little bit fiery, but I believe everything I wrote. And I got this one really bad review, and it was from this guy.
Which is the only one you remember, right? You only remember the bad review.
You can praise me until the cows come home, and I'll be like, remember that really mean guy? And this guy was clearly someone who was a baby boomer, because he was very upset about the way that I had talked about intergenerational wealth. Now, my mum's a baby boomer, and she's poor as hell and she worked really hard her whole life. I've never made a generational assessment about this, but on the data, baby boomers have done pretty well when it comes to amassing property for their kids. And I mean, why wouldn't you, right? You love your kids. But it's not like that for everyone. And the more that that stuff happens, the more inheritances there are. Maybe I could inherit the English language at some point. But the more that this stuff accumulates at a certain end, it just gets like the greatest. The Grattan did a report basically on wealth accumulation in Australia, and it's all in property. Like, it's almost all in property. It's not in cash. It's not in any other assets. It's in property. And missing out, you know, if your parents now don't have a house that they can bequeath to you, as lovely parents would, then you are also fucked. And then you are doubly fucked for your kids. Sorry to keep swearing. I'm from regional Queensland. and the sun is hot. It makes me forget myself. And so, I mean, that's the thing that kind of drives me wild. And there's this idea, you know, every story you hear about people who's, you know, young people who jumped into the property market, you just look for the paragraph where it's like, and my parents gave me $50,000. And I'm like, that's how much my mum's house cost. Like,
yeah, I just wanted to jump in on the thing that Rick was saying at the start about how housing should be about shelter and stability. And it's interesting to me how so often it's not. It's about an investment. It's about, you know, wealth accumulation. And you've got a kind of, I suppose, legal architecture that incentivizes a view of housing that is about investment and wealth accumulation rather than stripping it back to its real primal purpose, which is, at the end of the day, a safe place to live.
And just really, sorry, Mark.
That's right.
I mean, back in the day, I'm not prejudging anyone who's done all these things, right? Back in the day, I would have done the same thing. Like, if I had a stable job, solid income, and the housing, like, Australia's booming, we've got, you know, places to grow and things to do. But over time, that trend then becomes something that sets other boundaries in the property market and makes it more difficult for other people with the tax incentives the way they are to get access to. So it's just something that we need to have a mature conversation, I think, about what is, how many houses is enough?
Yeah.
I don't want to take them off.
You can make an argument, be a courageous Australian politician to say, right, we're going to have another crack at negative gearing.
Well, they
given
need
their
to.
Political experience.
They
right?
need to. And the yeah. coalition, I mean, Frydenberg knew that negative gearing was part of the problem. To a lesser extent, capital gains tax, but it's all part of the problem. And funnily enough, it's a really easy way to raise a whole lot of money, tens of billions of dollars for that budget repair that's been put off.
But, I mean, it's just it's a fascinating moment, isn't it? There are many residents of Sydney who've made more money in the last month on capital appreciation of their home than they will have ever earned in a month at any other time of their life, just by surviving 30 days, right?
The median house price, what, just hit 1.2 or
1.3 million? 1.3 million. And so I just wonder, do you see a political cost in that? Is that just great news for the government that there'll be people happy their houses increased, great news because it will drive people in the market, so there'll be stamp duty bonuses that come through for the state government? Or does that fault line of I've missed that and I have no way of catching that bus that left without me, does that create concern in Canberra?
Yeah, can I just really quickly, before I throw it, just be like, you take it. I remember hearing someone say, and I can't remember who it was, but from a conservative politics lens, the biggest mistake conservatives have made is not ensuring housing affordability. Because if you dig into the rhetoric, it's all about the nuclear family, raising kids, you know, being able to do your thing. Now, obviously, I don't think that that's necessary and you don't need all those things, but that's what conservatives believe, right? And their biggest mistake politically, which is going to come to bite them relatively soon, is the fact that they haven't allowed that for the younger generation. And suddenly now, whether you want to call it envy or jealousy or just be like, hey, maybe it's not laissez-faire, it's laissez-unfair. And maybe we've made a mistake now by not giving access to that sense of stability through Australia's favourite option, which is home ownership, white picket fence or one-bedroom apartment.
Rick, you've written so eloquently about growing up in regional Queensland. Put a regional lens on this experience now of the last 12 months. And how you think our politics is engaging with the challenges that people living in regional and rural Australia are seeing and living through?
I mean, so I've spent my whole, you know, life up until the age of 18 in regional Australia. And, you know, it's a pretty good upbringing. It's a pretty good life. But it always seemed crazy to me that the National Party was considered to be the party of the bush, because it certainly wasn't the party of our family. You know, single mum raising three kids, healthcare, you know, employment opportunities outside of a coal mine. My mum's not a canary. Don't fancy sending her down there. She's 62. And so there's this whole kind of class of people, whether they're working poor, working class, not attached to agriculture, you know, artists moving into regional communities, all of these people who are not represented. Farmers are barely represented by the National Party anymore, right? And they've got all those ads and there's lots of crops in there, but there's not people who are actually represented by them. It's coal. And so I find that quite devastating from an economics point of view, because there are more people per capita, or per head anyway, from all of these other kind of experiences in life that are not represented politically very well at all.
But if you look at, say, what's happened in by-elections in New South Wales, National Party seats have come up, and the Shooters, Fishers and whatever, they have won those seats or had massive swings. Why isn't the National Party reading that electoral reality that you discussed there?
Well, I think they are, and now they're panicking. And it's kind of like, it's like, you know, saying that you don't want to play with a toy and then picking something else, and then your friend, like a four-year-old toddler or whatever, grabs the toy that you didn't want, and then you're like, oh my God, I want that thing. Like, now they're like, oh, electorally, maybe we should represent people in this representative system of politics that we have. Radical thought, I know, but it's, I think there are certainly in New South, like John Barilaro, a lot of this kind of Gladys Berejiklian kind of drama with the koalas and the hoo-ha and all the rest of it, I can't even remember the details, just Koalagate, was basically because of the Shooters and Fishers. And so when you, and I'm not saying this is always a good thing, and I'm not saying the people who are upset are always good people, or people who are, you know, not racist or misogynist or anything like that. But when you discredit an entire cohort of people, or you miss them politically, then it's kind of like one of those great origin stories in Marvel comics for a villain to emerge. And this is when you get the Pauline Hansons and the Shooters and Fishers. Those are people who are not necessarily bad people voting for them, not always. And you miss them. And then they go and do stuff like this and just gerrymander the electoral system for, you know, give us all great headaches, I think.
Yeah, I think the other interesting thing that's come up, and there's a lot of terrain that Rick's just traversed there, but you got this by-election coming up in the Upper Hunter when we're on the topic of New South Wales by-elections, and it's interesting to see just how aggressively hard the Nationals have gone after the coal vote. And I think perhaps this is a symptom of the kind of short-termism in our politics, and probably why the Nats are going to have to change their tune, but probably haven't yet, because, you know, they can still rely on the sugar hit of playing the same politics that got them elected in those seats for you know, decades past. But that is going to run out, and they're going to have to change the calculus. You see the Shooters and Fishers chipping away, but you even see sort of, you know, independents also chipping away at those seats. I think that, yeah, the future of how that political movement operates is kind of fascinating to me, because yeah, they do have a very, I suppose, one-dimensional way of trying to do politics in those places, but they can sort of continue to do that for a little while longer, and they're perhaps not going to change up.
I mean,
while they can still do that?
At least there's coal in the Hunter Valley. I mean,
well, yeah,
there's not coal in some other national electorates, yeah. And they're just like, what about coal? I'm like, what are you doing?
Have a go, get a go. I mean, implicit in all of that is that Australia will look after those who look after themselves. Right, the individual, there are rewards to the individual and there's payback for individual effort. Part of your important reporting, Rick, and most recently in the Saturday paper, has been on the NDIS and a searing critique on how that program has been rolled out and serious questions about whether, in fact, appropriate levels of funding have been identified to fulfil the initial promise of the NDIS. Tell us how you think your reporting and the coverage of the NDIS and the critique of the NDIS is received in Canberra, but also more broadly in the community. How compassionate do you feel Australians are around a well-funded, well-operating NDIS in an era of have a go, get a go?
Yeah. I like to be optimistic about these things. And I think, I mean, the NDIS has always been this thing that kind of, it captured the Australian consciousness early on. People were very happy to support it. There was always this kind of rump of criticism about it being a boondoggle and costing too much. And I think, unfortunately, part of the problem with what we're now going to go into for the next 5 years is this idea that to get it over the line, and I don't blame them for this, but Julie Gillard and the other ministers were like, it's a $22 billion scheme, it's a silver bullet, and we're going to map out all these kind of territories. When states and whatnot have to do some stuff and then the NDIS will fix the rest of it and there'll be a clear line down the middle. Now, that was never true, partly because they'd never done the modelling, right? And so Australians are very, I think, generally speaking, if you are honest with them and you tell them that this is a fair-minded and decent thing, then the parameters are set and they'll support it. What's happened now is essentially 8 years of undermining. Now, some of the issues that we have with the NDIS are problems from the modelling before the coalition took power. A lot of them are because, Senator Mitch Fifield, when he was assistant minister, privatised all the planners. And so they outsourced, literally thousands of jobs to a sector that the agency in control of the NDIS never trusted anyway, didn't give them any power or real responsibility. And then they got wildly inaccurate and different inconsistent planning decisions for similar people with disabilities with similar kind of needs. And now they're using that as an excuse to say we need to bring in this robo-planning thing with independent assessments and we're going to gut, $5 billion from the scheme. And that's, they're engineering not just a scheme to reflect their kind of bitterness about what they had to fund, because they just want it to be a welfare system, right? They don't want it to be the world's leading disability scheme. They just want it to be a handout and they can cap it and say, this is what the government does, you don't get any more. And as at the same time they're doing that, they're now trying to bring the Australian public with them by saying, that thing that you very generously supported, well, I'm sorry, but now, sex workers are being paid for in one case. And Stuart Robert very deliberately used the word prostitute because he just knows he's got a tabloid sensibility, right? And so it scares me because the NDIS could be an amazing thing. But there was a window in time in which it could have been delivered perfectly. And I think that window is gone. And now people are really afraid of what's going to be left at the end of it.
Mm. Keisha, how compassionate do you see, in a sense, the Australian electorate, the Australian community on other issues? We're talking about support for India, given all that we've seen in India now. Just give us a read on where you think an Australian public would be about digging deep and in a practical way to support India, given the crisis that's engulfed it now.
I think we're generally a compassionate people, but I think compassion has limits, and we've probably seen the limits of that compassion really on display during this pandemic. When we talk about India, I reckon there'd be plenty of support for sending money or ventilators or whatever out there. There wouldn't be much support for bringing planes in, and that's probably why the government has been pretty willing to say, let's stop flights coming in. It's very interesting to me, though, they didn't do that about the US and the UK when they had similar case numbers. Now, what is different about people from India compared to a lot of people in the US and UK? I can't quite put my finger on it, but there's something there, I suspect, which again,
What is it?
I want to tell myself. But again, that shows where compassion has limits. I think that compassion and the way we view, who we want to extend that to is always going to be filtered through our own kind of general biases. Often those biases are racial. And a really good example of how that played out during the pandemic was if you look back to Melbourne last year, one of the first things they did was lock down those public housing tower blocks with, large sort of immigrant Muslim and East African populations, right? And that was done so impulsively. They were so comfortable with putting that into complete lockdown without giving people the chance to feed themselves, right? That was seen as a sort of compassionate response because it would save the rest of Melbourne. Obviously, they had to lock the whole city down after that, so it really didn't. But that, I think, exposes where that compassion has limits. There's a degree of comfort even among so-called progressive governments with sort of marginalising an outsider and locking that outsider out. I think that's where we see the limits of our compassion. It's always tempered by the biases that we are comfortable with kind of continuing with and not interrogating.
Isha, you talked about the university sector earlier, and it was clearly a very deliberate decision by the federal government not to include the universities as part of JobKeeper. Why was that? Why were the universities signalled out for that kind of treatment, do you think?
Well, there are two explanations for this. One is that they didn't meet the criteria several times over, which I suppose is that's the headline explanation for this. I guess the more cynical explanation is that they were left out by design, and the even more cynical explanation of that for that is they were left out by design because conservative coalition governments have never really liked universities very much. I mean, firstly, there's that sort of broad suspicion of them as like simmering hotbeds of like cultural Marxism and all that nonsense. But I think if you look at how they've been treated historically over the last couple of decades, you know, there was that huge effort by the Abbott government to deregulate university fees. Or I think that they kind of wanted during this pandemic as well to sort of stamp their vision on what the sector would look like. So that would be, you know, lecturing them for being too dependent on international students, even though they had to do that because they were getting their funds cut for decades. That was also, you know, being like, you're losing thousands of jobs, whatever, that's fine. That was also saying, we are going to jack up the prices of arts degrees and we're going to send a very, very strong signal here that university is not a place to, you know, roll around and frivolously soak up all that cultural Marxism. It is a place for you to go and get your job. This is a place for you to go and do your engineering degree and come out with a qualification. And that is, I think, a very sort of rigid and ideological view of universities. But I think it's all part of the same kind of attitude towards these institutions. And I think it's an attitude that is born out of this, I suppose, historical suspicion of the sector. But maybe that's just a cynical explanation. I don't know.
Now we have time for a quick question. I'm going to channel my inner Tony Jones. We're after questions, not comments. But we'll start with you, sir, over here.
Twice I have heard in this talk today that we're lucky that Australia is an island. And I have used that phrase to someone who recently returned from London, and she said to me, the UK is an island too. To my question, I was worried in the late 90s about the Asian financial crisis. I was more worried about the global financial crisis. For a long time, I believed in peak oil, and so far it has not happened. Last week, I heard on LNL radio, Late Night Live, that out of all US dollars on this planet, one out of four was created in a single year, 2020. What do you have to throw at the economy to mark it with a dent?
Climate change. Like, I mean, we're all going to get distracted pretty soon, I reckon. I mean, and for better or worse, I don't know what else there is. I mean, I didn't... Funnily enough, I dropped out of university and then I certainly didn't encounter any cultural Marxism while I was there. I'm like, who? Who that guy? But I, you know, I've never had words for these things. So, I'm a little bit uneducated when it comes to, well, what actually do you do? I think something big has to happen before we correct course on any of these things because, you know, it's like a child. You don't learn a lesson unless there's a consequence. And I just don't think the people who needed to learn the consequences have learned any yet, if that makes
sense. Keisha, got to be on that?
I guess just jumping off that stuff about climate change, maybe the problem, and I think the problem for many years is that it doesn't have this kind of like sudden flashpoint, right? It's the kind of boiling frog situation and suddenly we're just going to be completely boiled. I don't know when we're going to get there, but, you know, instead of it coming in flashpoints, it's just like this sort of slow burn of things getting worse and worse, of the emissions rising, of the point of no return sort of receding back in the rearview mirror. And Yeah, I think it's interesting because I thought that COVID could maybe be a kind of jolt and could really change a lot of things. And in some ways it sort of did, like we saw a Liberal government spending big, but so much of the kind of broader architecture of the kind of, I guess, late capitalist world is relatively in place and hasn't been touched by the pandemic. And so much of that is still going. I don't know, maybe that's a real downer to end this answer on, but yeah, maybe we'll just stick with the downer for now because I don't have a solution.
Your question, sir. Yeah.
So you guys are saying a lot in this talk about Australia being very lucky with what happened with our COVID situation. But if you compare Australia to what happened in New Zealand, where they were given the best response to COVID in the world by, I think it was the WHO, how is it that we are lucky when we had almost identical circumstances to New Zealand and much worse outcome?
Well, we were luckier than them. They were luckier than us, but not by... I mean, globally, we were... We did okay. I mean, obviously, there are really bad examples of things that went wrong. I mean, I guess the simple answer is Jacinda Ardern. It's a much smaller community. Well, it's more regionalised.
And no need for national... Her cabinet is the national cabinet,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, there isn't a state and territory kind of... But she's also like, if Scott Morrison was the Prime Minister of New Zealand, they'd be USA-ing right now. Just, you mark my words.
Yeah, I think a lot of the factors that make Australia lucky, the island, small population, geographical isolation, relatively well-educated and comfortable with following rules are probably factors that New Zealand maybe has a little bit more of. But yeah, I think there's no question that they did certain things better, but I think that maybe they were in a position to do those things better. Still, if we're looking at global rankings, New Zealand were number one. We weren't too far behind. So, I mean, we have been down in Australia a lot over the last hour, but I think credit where it's due. We did, with the exception of, you know, certain big, big failings that have been well litigated over the past year, we did do pretty well.
Next question.
Majority governments are considered preferable for providing stability and getting things done, but we've had many majority governments and yet we haven't made any progress on many of the long-term problems. So what's the point of a majority government, and would we be better off with a minority government with a balance of power held by sensible centre independents who could push for progress on these issues?
Ooh, I mean, the last experience we had of a minority government, they actually got a lot of things done. So much of that was ripped apart within a few years. And it was ripped apart within a few years, I think, in part because there was a lot of, or there was the sense of chaos coming from that minority government that was one of the reasons that turned voters off or whatever. You know, we can go back to the 2013 election as much as we want, but yeah, they did get a lot done. I think it's really a kind of a question of who those sensible centrists are, though, right? Because I could foresee a situation where the balance of power might not be held by people who are particularly sensible, but might be held by, One Nation or people like that. It really depends on who's holding that balance of power. I don't think that there's necessarily a strictly majority-minority dichotomy.
But do you see the possibility of a rise of more Zali-Stegall-type independents? And for a long time, an independent was never elected to the lower house, and now that threshold is... changed.
Yeah, I don't want to speculate too much, but I think we will definitely see more of that in the next election. And I guess it's a question of who is in power, who they are. It's hard to speculate as to whether they'll deliver better outcomes, but that is certainly a trend that I think we're going to see more of.
And I think you're more likely to get the centralists in the lower house than you do in the upper house, where the voting threshold is that much lower in order to get appointed. Thank you for that. Last question.
So in the discussion around the NDIS scheme, the word compassionate was used quite a lot, and I find that a little bit problematic. Prefaces were saying that years and years ago I did a little bit of a political economy at uni. The use of the word compassion sort of indicates charity in that it's not something that's a right. And it's interesting how that's not as applied as much to the increase in job seeker, yet it's used a lot more around the NDIS scheme, you know. And, you know, that's problematic because that, you know, support for disability, as a citizen, you should be able to get that. Not to mention, you know, there is a whole economy based around the NDIS scheme that supports manufacturers, you know, support workers, disability homes, you know. So the NDIS scheme not only impacts the participants, but a whole range of other players in there as well. So I'd say that, to me, that almost seems like, in a way, the government kind of being successful in subverting the narrative in how we speak about disability and in achieving their aims. So I guess my question is, you know, how careful are you about, when do you realise that you're kind of not paying as much attention as you should be, and what hope do the rest of us have in trying to, you know, keep an independent narrative from the government as the mainstream?
Well, I mean, that's kind of what they're doing, right? They're stripping out the rights-based approach, which is currently enshrined in the legislation, to take it away from people, because it is a human right. And I've written heaps about the fact that the right to touch is a human right. Stuart Robert has used this federal court case with a sex worker providing sex therapy to a chronically disabled, profoundly disabled woman who cannot achieve sexual release on her own. Now, we might not think about that as being a right, but it is. And that's the stuff that is at risk. The whole idea of them turning it into a welfare kind of capped system is the antithesis of rights. And, you know, all of our reporting, certainly at the Saturday paper, focuses on that. And using the word compassion or whatnot. I mean, I think most Australians attach to the word compassion. And most, I mean, people, certainly people I grew up with, right, in regional Queensland, they're not thinking about what's the rights-based approach. They just go, well, what is the kind thing to do? Or what is the decent and fair thing to do? Now, I think you're right. It is problematic when we're starting to talk about, no, this isn't an option. We need to do this properly, and these people are the same as us, and this is the whole point of it, so they can live a life just like ours.
I mean, my point is it's unintentionally dangerous.
Yeah.
You know? And it seems to move around. You know, we used to talk about people on the pension like that, and that is definitely far from the reality of what the pension is supposed to be for hardworking Australians that have retired.
Well, that's what the fight is for with the NDIS. Like, we don't want to move that window, because as soon as you do, you lose the NDIS as it's originally conceived.
Thank you for your question, and that's all the time we have today. So will you join me in thanking Keisha Napier-Rama and Rick Morton?
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, please subscribe to and rate our channel wherever you listen to your podcasts.